Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome, UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back my great guest co-host, Dr. Warren Perry. Welcome, Warren.
Thank you.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Mark Hedstrom, Senior Vice President of the Movember Foundation. That's right, Movember Foundation, about men's health and why you might see a few more mustaches in November. You heard of Movember?
I have. Movember, I've actually participated a couple years.
Well, I'm looking forward to having the conversation. I have not participated, but maybe this year I can. You'll have to tell me how. But first, we've got some really interesting research that matters, and let's dive right in. We're going to be talking about initially vaccines and microparticles and three-dimensional fabrication. What?
Yeah, it appears like this article, what they did, and this is an article out of research out of MIT, and it looks like what they've done is they've designed a type of coffee cup sort of thing, like we use today with the Keurigs, and they've put vaccinations in there that can be released over time. So in developing nations where children might not have access to primary care physicians and pediatricians to get routine vaccination schedules, they can just get one shot and then be covered for a certain amount of time for certain diseases.
Yeah, this was published actually in the journal Science, so this is not a small piece of research to be published in that fine a journal, funded by the Gates Foundation. And yeah, they talk about these kind of sealed cups, and all these little ones kind of combined together, and certain cups would kind of degrade in the body when injected at different time periods and release that vaccination. It sounds kind of like science fiction, but they actually did this in mice.
Yeah, they did. They did do it in mice, and it did show that the mice themselves...
Yeah, they had these impacts at different days where the drugs were released to get the levels that they indicated, these vaccinations, you know, up to 1 or 2 months after injection. And they even did, I think, found out in one of the models that they had a strong immune response several months after the injection. So this is moving forward. I find this incredibly exciting. We know, I mean, as a parent, I can tell you, no one as a parent likes and even have never met a child who wants to get multiple injections at one visit, much less multiple injections over multiple visits. If you could reduce that, that would be a huge breakthrough.
Amazing, yes.
Yeah, well, I think we stay tuned to that research. We're really looking forward to the next evolution of it. This next research warms my heart, warms my mind. It's about listening to music and creativity. Do you like listening to music, Warren?
I do.
What type of music do you like?
I like all kinds of music.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I kind of like all music, too. I listened to some blues this weekend, and despite the blues having kind of a overwhelming sense of things in life, it just made me kind of happy, and I love listening to it. And this is research that's looking at, does creativity seem to improve with certain types of music? Can it make you, you know, music that makes you either calm or happy or sad or anxious, if it arouses you a little bit or a lot, does that have an impact on what they call creativity, the things that make you think more broadly or the things that let you problem solve by really drilling down? What did they find?
Well, they found that listening to happy music, such as classical music, which some people might like to listen to, allows you to be more creative, to, like you said before, think more outside the box and find more solutions for a problem, or just indefinitely think about something a little bit more tightly just by listening to happier music.
Yeah, this was actually in the journal PLOS One, PLOS One, a really good journal for which you actually, any listener, this particular journal, its articles are made free of charge to anyone. So
wow.
Any one of our listeners can look up this particular article, which was came from researchers in the Netherlands and from Australia. And, you know, I think I'm not sure you can tell your boss that you're just listening to music to help your creativity, but certainly if you're in an environment and you have some headphones on, that may be something that would help. That sounds like a good idea to me.
I do it all the time. And after reading this article, I thought to myself, I feel like I do think a lot more clearer and my thoughts are a lot more productive when I listen to classical music. So there might be some validity in this.
As long as you don't listen to it too loud.
Exactly.
We don't want the hearing to go down. Well, I think this is research that we're excited about, and hopefully it has some real applications. Let's talk about our next research that matters, Warren. It's actually maybe something that may be similar but maybe different, which is mind wandering. I think when you're listening to music, which you might while you're driving, this is the converse of something where you actually need to pay attention to something like driving. And is your mind wandering? Has this ever happened to you when you're driving?
Shamefully, it has happened a couple times.
Yeah, I'd say it's happened a lot more than that to me. You know, you're on call at night, you're driving home, you're driving a long distance, you've had a long day. And sometimes you get to wherever you're going and you're going, God, I don't even remember how I got there. And you're just and you get all kind of this like scared feeling, which is, were you mind wandering? And I guess the good news is that's very common. It can happen up to 70% of the time at driving. But on the other hand, that's worrisome.
Yeah, it is. It is. The study that we're talking about, you know, took a bunch of people and a bunch of volunteers, and they put them in a simulation and they put electrodes on their head to study their brain waves and then had them simulate driving what we call the monotonous pathway. And in between, to simulate a long day at work, they had them do this written test and then had them simulate driving back. And they found that upwards about 70% of the volunteers stated that they're mind wandering during this time period.
What's remarkable is they also, these volunteers heard a buzzer at different points in time to indicate, you know, is their mind wandering right then? So despite this random buzzing, despite taking written tests, despite this simulation with electrodes on their head, they were mind wandering. There's not much hope for us.
Yeah.
But I do think this suggests, you know, we're developing autonomous smart cars, right? Mm-hmm. Can't we have smart technology that helps detect when we could be wandering and, you know, delivers some sort of intervention?
Well, there's the self-driving cars now, but there's also cars that have automatic brakes now that I've seen on TV where if you don't see somebody running in front of you, the car brakes automatically. So now there's like some safety features in cars to help us out because maybe the car industry has figured out this before we have.
Yeah, I think you're right. I know for lots of cars today, if you go outside the lane, you hear like you're going over some bumpers. And first 10 times you do that, go, why my car doing that? And you recognize it's a feature of the car to keep you in your lane. I think this is on the right track. I think this is a big issue. Anything we can do to stay focused and attentive and using technology in this case, I think that's a good idea.
I do too.
Let's talk about our last research that matters. And this is an article about the mind, and it's about psychiatric diagnoses, in particular maternal psychiatric diagnoses. Mothers pregnant who have a diagnosis of depression or panic disorder or an anxiety disorder, and is there a real risk to their babies, really, I guess, just from having that diagnosis? And this is a study that looked at that.
Yeah. So the study looked at mothers who had certain disorders, panic disorders and anxiety disorders, and they did found that there was some correlation with effects on their baby, like slightly low birth weights and so forth, but nothing that was significant enough to really impact the baby long term. So even the drugs that they were on too, such as benzodiazepines, which are certain classes of drugs that patients might be on.
Things like Valium or Ativan, clonazepam, and then the antidepressant medications, SSRIs, things like Prozac or Zoloft or Paxil. In general, those drugs do have some impact. That does not mean by any means that you should stop those drugs if you have those conditions, because having untreated depression, panic disorder, or anxiety disorder would not be good either. But it suggests that properly treated, you can have minimized risk. This was in the journal JAMA Psychiatry, and over 2,600 women at 137 clinical practices throughout Connecticut and Massachusetts. Actually, I think done at one of your alma maters, Yale.
Yes.
Must be a good study.
It has to be an excellent study then.
That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Mark Hedstrom, Senior Vice President of the Movember Foundation, about men's health and why you might see a few more mustaches this month. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. Today on Conversations, Warren, we're talking with Mark Hedstrom, Senior Vice President of the Movember Foundation. That's right, Movember Foundation, about men's health and why you might see a few more mustaches than you've seen before. Welcome to Your Health.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Mark, I think we had to do a double take there because obviously some listeners would think that we had misspoke and said November rather than Movember. Tell us why that's not a misspoken word.
The Movember Foundation is actually a foundation that was founded in 2003 in Australia. And Mo in Australian slang is short for mustache. So we took both the word Movember, the month of, and then put Mo on the front of it to translate it into Movember. And really what it's about is from that inception back in 2003 through today and to the future is engaging men in a fun way about some serious causes that we look to tackle in the world. So we've taken the mustache and actually made that a fun way to get men and women to talk about some of the men's health issues that we look to tackle.
And why are you interested in this? Tell us, how did you get involved? I suspect you didn't necessarily think this is what you would be doing when you went to college.
But no, probably not. And I don't think my parents quite understood when I first explained it to them as
You're
to what I was doing for a living, to be honest with you. And look, my father growing up had an epic mustache. I mean, he's a physician. He's out of practice now. He's retired. But, you know, it's one of those things for me personally. You know, I've had a connection to cancer. My mother's a breast cancer survivor. Two of my uncles are prostate cancer survivors. And also, I have people close to me in my family that struggle with mental health challenges, and particularly the men in my life. So for me personally, it's always been a connection to the cause and what we do. And we focus on prostate and testicular cancer as well as men's mental health. So all those things I've always experienced through others in my family and something I've wanted to be involved in for quite some time. So I had the opportunity when Movember came along about 5 years ago. I've been with the organization for that period of time. I got lucky, quite frankly, to land into a position and really help the organization and the men in our lives.
I commend you for taking on that the task of men's health. Definitely something that needs to be done. You talk about that Movember Foundation focuses on prostate and testicular cancer. Can you just elaborate to the public about that and specifically talk about how men are affected and what are the cancer rates and so forth?
Sure, absolutely. So let me talk to prostate cancer first. So prostate cancer is the second leading cause of cancer or diagnosed cancer amongst men in the U.S., skin cancer being number one. So it's a fairly prevalent disease and highly diagnosed. About 220,000 men in the U.S. in a given year are diagnosed with prostate cancer, and unfortunately about 28,000 of those men pass from the disease. In your lifetime, 1 in 8 men in your lives will be affected by prostate cancer, and it's even more serious for African-American men and some of the other populations that we look to serve, and that you actually see it going from 1 in 8 in the general population in the U.S. to more like 1 in 6 for African-American men. So there's a unique challenge with prostate cancer. I think unlike what you see, and you know, we've always been complimentary of the breast cancer awareness movement, men aren't as aware, or people aren't aware of what's happening with prostate cancer. And a lot of what we're trying to do through, you know, the Trojan horse of the mustache is to educate men in a fun way about some of the serious challenges they face. If you shift gears to testicular cancer is the leading cause or diagnosed cancer amongst men between 18 and 35. Now, if caught early, both of these diseases are actually quite treatable, and men have a longer period of life after treatment. So particularly with testicular cancer, one of the big challenges is because of the age range of men that are affected by it, you know, the kids who are in college or just coming out of school, you know, they're less concerned or less engaged in their own health. So how do we engage them in that conversation? Because if testicular cancer is caught early, it's quite survivable. The survival rates if caught early are above 95%. So how do we educate men around these particular areas of focus where we can use something as simple as a mustache to get them engaged and understand exactly some of the health risks that they face.
You know, when I think about men's health and I think about the two cancers you've just mentioned, you know, in my medical training, certainly testicular cancer and the importance of teaching self-exam and being able to do it and then having uncovered a couple cases in a career, you really feel empowered to continue. The prostate cancer is a difficult one, I think, for at least for primary care physicians, because the test itself isn't perhaps good enough. The digital exam doesn't seem to be good enough. It seems that we're really suffering almost from a research lack that we haven't developed more. And I'm wondering, why is that? And is your foundation seeking to really improve diagnostic testing and early detection capabilities in ways that really are less controversial and maybe have stronger impacts?
Exactly right. So from our perspective, we look at it in two ways. One is diagnosis as well as treatment. So when you step back and look at the PSA, which is the base test that one would look for in terms of diagnosing and understanding whether or not a man is at risk for prostate cancer, there have been some challenges with that. From our perspective, our recommendation is if you have a history of prostate cancer in your family, and that would be your father, your uncles, your brothers, or your African-American male, that at age 45, you should talk to your physician about whether or not you should be getting a PSA. If you're at age 50, we would also recommend that you talk to your physician about getting a PSA. Now, the challenge with the PSA itself and what we're trying to tackle is not just looking for therapies, so radiation therapies or other immunotherapies to solve for certain types of prostate cancer, but also bring it forward to your point around how do we improve upon the PSA with better tests and diagnosis around things like biomarkers. So we invest heavily to one of our large programs that we call the Global Action Plan in that particular set of problems. So how do we improve the diagnostics around prostate cancer so we can better inform men of the types of prostate cancer they have and those that need to be treated? We're also obviously focused on the treatment itself, so looking for better drug therapies, working with others in industry to actually improve the lives of men who are going through treatment. The last piece I'd mention is that's all about men who are going through the disease, so diagnosing and then currently in treatment. One of the big things that we found in our 13-plus years is looking at all the decisions that go around being told that you have prostate cancer. So we've taken that back, and we've actually invested in a global initiative called True North. And think of it as helping a man and their family navigate the moment they are told that they have prostate cancer. How does the man and that individual family make the right decisions about their treatment and be better informed throughout their treatment? So we're not just looking at diagnostics and therapies. We're also looking at how do we help men navigate that journey.
Sounds like you're really tackling this issue from a lot of angles. Again, I really commend you on this. I have kind of a two-part question. I really want to know how many people participate in Movember each year, and one from the standpoint of people who grow mustaches, but then people who might be a little bit facial disinclined, not be able to grow a mustache, how can they participate in Movember and still contribute?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's, it can be a bit challenging. I mean, I had to convince first my parents that this was actually a job when I took it on, and then I had to convince my wife that I was going to be growing a mustache every November. So, really as a couple, and we try to make it as easy as possible. So in a given year, we have about 500,000 men and then women, not growing mustaches, but women participating as community members. And then we have a bunch of donors that sit behind those individuals. So in a given year, we have over 1 million people participating, either directly through growing a mustache or as a woman by engaging in physical activity or donating to the men in their lives throughout a course of a year. And we've had about just under 6 million people since our inception engage in Movember in terms of growing mustaches. So we've sprouted certainly millions of mustaches across the world. But if you step back and you look at the donors that donate to individual community members as well as the people that those men and women are talking to, it's exponential in terms of getting the message across and raising the awareness around the areas that we focus on. And, for women, it's not just about, celebrating the men in their lives. It's also about getting them engaged, because what we found is women often can help men understand some of the challenges they face, educate them on that, but they can also participate. So we've not only engaged men in growing mustaches, but men and women in being physically active for the 30 days. As you know, if you do something for 30 days, typically that has a better chance of actually sticking with you. So we ask men and women to move for the 30 days of Movember, and that's a great way for women to engage not only in their own physical activity, but also with those of the men in their lives.
Yeah, and we all know that physical activity is one of the things that can maybe best help prevent prostate cancer and improve outcomes when people are undergoing care. So a great message. Well, we're going to need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with Mark Hedstrom, Senior Vice President of the Movember Foundation, about men's health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Your Health. And we've been talking with Mark Hedstrom, Senior Vice President of the Movember Foundation, about men's health. And right before the break, Mark, you were doing a really nice job of explaining to us some of the unique aspects that the Movember Foundation is doing to bring home the need and the opportunities for people to participate in advocating for men's health. And I wonder if we could just take even a step back and talk about, does our public health system, our clinical system, think differently about men's health, and why is that?
I think it's an interesting question, and this is not something just the U.S. society is challenged with. I mean, when we look at ourselves as a global organization, you know, we operate in 21 countries around the world, founded in Australia, moved to the U.S. in 2007, Canada, and the U.K. at the same time. So we have an interesting perspective on how do you engage men in health delivery or health services. And one of the things we've found, regardless of the society or, you know, the borders that you sit within, is that it's really hard to get men to go somewhere. You can get men to take action, but the reality is, in a lot of ways, what we found, whether it's talking about prostate cancer or talking about mental health, you have to go to where the men are. So what we mean by that is when we're looking at sporting events, men spend a lot of time there. How do we engage them at that point that, you know, they're open to a conversation about what we're trying to do? Men are often found in the workplace. So if you look at some of the workforces that are male-dominated, like firefighting, like mining, how do we engage men at that point to talk about some of the challenges that they face and ultimately how they take action with those? So we do it a little bit differently. You know, you're not going to get, in a lot of ways, men to go to someplace. They're not going to go seek health services in a lot of ways. And I think that's a big challenge. That's not to say all men are like that, but that's a unique challenge that we see. So how do you actually go to where they are? So how do you go into the community that men are living in, where they're already engaging, and actually engage them at that point? A great example, just quickly, is a barbershop. We do a lot of work. We've actually piloted and are continuing forward on an initiative called Mo-Rated Barbers. And this is a point where we know men are engaging. Oftentimes, more often than they see their physician, they're getting a haircut or a shave or a mustache trim, you know, every 6 to 8 weeks. And the barber is, you know, someone who can talk to them, engage them in both their physical and mental health, and use that individual conversation to help guide those men to the right place to seek out help. So one of the things we look at is how do we get to where men are and engage them when they're ready to have the conversation.
That's interesting you said that. Even though I am bald, I do get my mustache trimmed up, and I can definitely say going to the barbershop is definitely therapeutic, so that makes perfect sense to me. Now that you've been in here for like over 10 years now, right, doing the foundation? Is that correct?
That is, yes. This year is our 10th anniversary in the U.S.
Well, congratulations. Where do you see yourselves going 5 years from now, 10 years from now, just with testicular cancer, prostate cancer, and even mental health?
Sure. With respect to the cancers, I mean, our hope obviously is with our investment as well as others who focus on prostate cancer globally is that we're getting to a point where we're solving for the disease. So those 28,000 men in the U.S., we're pushing that number as close to zero as possible. And then we're dealing with, you know, population men are still being diagnosed, but ultimately with things like True North and better diagnostics, we're helping them better navigate that journey so they live a longer period of time. So from our perspective, we set ourselves 2030 goals. And what we're looking to do is saying in the next, you know, if we look at ourselves in another 13 years, where would we want to be in terms of men's health with the areas that we focus on? So when we look at prostate cancer, we'd love to drop that percentage of men dying from the disease by 25%, the same with testicular cancer. And a lot of that, as you guys know, is in some ways it's about prevention and early intervention. It's not just about waiting till the man shows up and has a problem and treating them, but how do we do a lot of the work that we're trying to do with some of our campaigns around educating men and getting into the prevention conversation. So preventing men from having these challenges before they seek treatment. So when we look at that, we know that, you know, by 2030, if we can get those numbers moving in the right direction, you know, 25% reduction in both testicular and prostate cancer, we're on the right path to actually solving for the disease. With respect to mental health, I think, you know, to be serious for a second, one of the really unique challenges that we see with respect to men's health, but mental health in particular, is just the number of suicides that are occurring globally. And, you know, we just completed a campaign around this issue. But if you look at the number of suicides just in the U.S. alone, according to the CDC, you know, about 42,000 Americans take their own lives each year. And that's a really unfortunate number. What's more unfortunate and more shocking for us is that about 75% of those are men. So you have about 32,000 men, 31,000 men taking their own lives each year. So our question is, what do we do about that? And so from our perspective, when we look at 2030, we want to be aggressive as possible. And, again, it's not just us. There's a lot of great work that's happening out there in the world around suicide prevention. But we would love to see that number cut in half by 2030. We would love to see the number of men not considering that option for themselves to be halved in the next 17 years.
You know, your organization has done some really interesting, I would say, innovative work on YouTube to help drive home and get people paying attention to messages. Maybe you could describe this. If I were going and looking on YouTube and I happened to see a man explaining how to make a fishing rod or fill a gas barbecue tank or change a flat tire, what might I see?
Sure. So you can go to YouTube and just go to the Movember Foundation page or Facebook page. We have a couple of them for each of the markets that we're in, but Movember Foundation USA is a Facebook page here in the States. And really what last year we ran a campaign around that suicide notes talk too late. And what we found in that conversation, and that was pretty hard-hitting, it was men who had actually tried to take their own lives or attempted to take their own lives, the notes they had left behind to their loved ones. It was a pretty powerful piece, and I think what we learned from that, though, is it's a really challenging conversation to get into. And you know, if we step back from that, and what we learned from that was it's actually just about getting men to talk in the first place. So if you go to Movember Foundation USA on Facebook or our YouTube channel, Movember Foundation, you'll see a couple different pieces. And the point behind when you go through your Facebook feed these days, oftentimes you'll see video content. Facebook's done a lot of work in creating video content, but the sound is always off. And you don't really know what's being said unless you click sound on. So we thought we would, you know, do a piece of work around what the guy is saying when he's telling you how to fix a bike tire or telling you how to do a barbecue or telling you how to create a fishing lure. The captions that you see when it's muted as you scroll through your feed, the guy's talking about how do you fix a bike tire. And the point is, if you unmute, you actually understand what he's saying, what he's talking about, some of the challenges he's facing in his own life. And the point behind that is to unmute for him. How do you engage men in your lives in a conversation? So take the time out. And we look at it from a perspective of how are you good stewards of mental health, and particularly for men. And it's this concept of ALEC, which is ask, listen, encourage, and then check in. So the whole point behind the unmute is if you actually step back and listen to what the man is saying, you can engage them in a conversation, encourage them to seek help, and then check in with them periodically to make sure they're doing okay.
That's a very creative way of addressing the issue. You know, as we talked about this, it sounds like you've tackled this issue, like I said, from a lot of avenues. You've given us ways that we can get involved with Movember, even if you can't even grow a mustache. is there any final thoughts you'd like to give the listeners, just in general?
Yeah, I think in terms of, you know, engage in the foundation's message. I mean, if you want to grow a mustache, we'd love to have you. I don't grow a great mustache myself, so you know, I encourage men if they want to give it a shot, and you know, if they have to ask permission of their partner, totally understand that as well. But go to Movember.com, understand what we're about, understand the areas that we focus on, and if anything, if you don't participate, maybe donate to someone that is participating, or at least spend some time in the our focus or our work sections of our site or your health and really understand what we're trying to do. Even if we engage men and women in the conversation around the risks that men face and they're better educated to have those conversations in their own lives, we're doing our job, and that's what we're most proud of.
Well, we're certainly proud of the work that you're doing and that the foundation is doing. It may be your job, but it's also listening to you, something that goes beyond, and it's a passion and vision, and we applaud that passion and vision.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We've been talking with Mark Hedstrom, Senior Vice President of the Movember Foundation, about men's health. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Warren, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about prostate-specific antigens and perhaps some controversy.
I know the controversy about the PSA, but I feel better getting them in my annual physical. My number's always been around 4, but suddenly over the past year, it's risen to around 6. My doctor said I should see a urologist and consider a biopsy. Is that really necessary?
Well, this is an area that's really important and one that our guest today was very passionate about, which is really improving the diagnostics for prostate testing. And I think there's really not much controversy about having an informed conversation about it. And if you choose to get testing, then certainly having it followed. And what we see here is a rise.
Yeah, I agree with you, Adam. And you probably could speak better on this than I can. But I think having an informed conversation, shared decision-making with your physician, and discussing the best management to go is the best thing to do.
Yeah, and in this particular case, it's been stable and it's increased. Now, part of this would be how old is the person? I mean, if the person were, you know, in their late 60s, early 70s and was healthy, then one has this conversation because you may have a long life expectancy. If not, then that may look different. Some people might say you should treat with some antibiotics. Maybe they have a symptom of enlarged prostate and treat that. But I think the standard of care would say it's increased, in this case, 50%, even though it doesn't seem like a lot. That is potentially a real – you may just do the test again first, but I think referring to urologist would probably be very wise in that case.
Yeah. I mean, referring to a urologist and just getting confirmation that it's nothing dangerous or significant, and if it isn't, then great. And if it is, at least you found it and you can start treatment.
Some people will do this – what's called this free kind of PSA then and try to differentiate the – PSA rise that's more dangerous from the one that's not. That's something, again, you can talk about with your physician, maybe with a urologist if you're seeing them. Thank you so much. We hope that everything turns out well. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm 60 years old, and I've noticed over the last 3 months that every time I tilt my head back, I have shooting pain going down my left arm. It doesn't bother me otherwise, so is this concerning?
Well, there's probably a lot of people, men and women, who really do empathize that when they turn their back a certain way, when they turn their neck a certain way, they get some shooting pains. You probably see people with shooting pains.
Oh, all the time.
All the time.
All the time. All the time I do. And yeah. So then in regards to your question, having pain in your neck and having it shoot down can be very alarming. The issue is it dangerous? Most likely what you probably are experiencing since you are 60 years old is most likely some arthritis in your neck pain. Those nerves come out of your spine and sometimes they can get irritated. And if you think about it, those nerves are going down to your arm. So when they get a little irritated about your neck, you can feel them down at your arm.
This is an easy thing to diagnose. Some x-rays of the neck that can be done in your primary care physician's office and most providers, or at least to get those x-rays, will diagnose it. The real question then is, you know, what to do about it. I think one of my relatives would have said, don't tilt your head back, you know. But it is this element of, you know, do the things that can protect your neck and don't do things that make your neck worse. And that's good common sense.
Yeah. No, I would agree. Again, like I say, always say know your triggers, try some talk to your doctor and learn some conservative ways to treat the pain.
Certainly, you can do some gentle massage, maybe some medications like ibuprofen or acetaminophen when it flares on you. Some people like heat. you may be careful about sudden movements of your neck. Hopefully that's helpful, and thank you for your question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've had a torn meniscus in my knee for many years, and I was doing just fine with 1 to 2 Percocets a day with my pain control. My doctor recently said that with all the recent attention on opiates, she felt it was too dangerous for me to continue on that medicine. I've tried other medicines as well as physical therapy. It seems like my only other option is surgery. Why can't I just stay on this medication rather than surgery?
Well, we need to really thank you for that sort of question because it's, you know, there's so much attention being paid, and rightfully so, on opioid abuse, on opioid deaths, on trying to cut down on opioid prescribing. And in general, that's something myself and most of my colleagues are really supportive of. That's a good thing.
No, I totally agree with your doctor. I would encourage him not to have you on long-term narcotics because they do have addictive properties and it could send you down a dark pathway.
What makes things difficult in this case is you felt like you were actually doing quite well. You were avoiding surgery. You were on, one would say, enough of the opiates that you might be a little dependent on them, but perhaps not enough if you've never abused them that you're not escalating, and certainly that's a safe amount. We assume you may have tried other non-opiate modalities like the physical therapy. You mentioned other medications, a lot of the pain sorts of specialty, and yet here you were doing fine and now you're not, which, you know, that's not a straightforward answer. We don't want you to have surgery if you didn't need it, but maybe you eventually did need the surgery.
Yeah. I mean, if that's where you're at right now, I think if you've pretty much exhausted all your other avenues of pain control and your only option is to be on chronic narcotics, I would go with the surgery option and physical therapy. And again, the other options haven't worked.
Yeah, I guess the only other question would be if you're in a situation where you couldn't actually afford the surgery.
Oh, yeah,
and we do have patients that don't have health insurance. And so then you kind of maybe feel like the Percocet may be very inexpensive compared to some other options. So I hear this. It's not so straightforward. We've applaud your doctor's intent, but we also know that you maybe need to have some more conversations perhaps with that doctor to talk about maybe some other ways of treating the pain. Because it sounds like that, whether it's an injection into the knee, maybe seeing an orthopedist. Well, thank you so much for that question. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I need to have surgery on my wisdom teeth, but I have severe needle phobia. What type of suggestions do you have for me?
Have you ever had your wisdom teeth out?
I have not, but I've had a tooth extracted, so I can definitely empathize with this listener. Good thing I'll tell you is that when it comes to needles, I think dentists have techniques that they use. So normally they numb you up with like a lidocaine gel or something like that to get you real numb, and they try to avoid you seeing the needle. So if you close your eyes, hopefully you won't see it being put into your mouth. And then there's a technique that I had to learn when I was doing nerve blocks in medical school and in residency, is they kind of pinch and wiggle your cheek so that it distracts you and you don't really feel the needle going in. And I can tell you this firsthand that I didn't even know I was getting the injection. Next thing I knew, my mouth was numb. So I don't think it's going to be as bad as you think.
Yeah, there's actually, I think, a biological basis. I think when you rub something, it actually pain, you know, if you rub something hard enough, it
dissipates
kind of,
it.
Yeah, when it does something with the pain fibers on there and it kind of numbs up the skin a little bit. So I do think that the dentists have learned it. But sometimes they say this will just like a little bee sting. And I'm like, bee stings hurt.
Yeah, yes.
I wonder if in this case there, you know, you wouldn't hate to say, well, put an IV in because that's a needle and maybe give something that way. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if this isn't something that talking with the dentist, I don't know if they could use a gas to put the patient out, be like conscious sedation. That may be something that needs to be done under certainly a controlled setting, but maybe then they could then do the procedures that they maybe need to do.
That's an option.
I remember having some gas when I had my wisdom teeth out, and I remember going, you're never going to put me to sleep. And they kept saying, count backwards from 10. I said, it's not going to work. And I think I got to 6. And then, of course, I woke up and I was completely done. I was like, I told you it's not going to work. And they were just all kind of laughing at me. And I'm sitting there just trying to figure out what's going on. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for Your Health. If you want to send your own questions, you can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my great co-host, Dr. Warren Perry, and our guest today, Mark Hedstrom. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Warren Perry.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.